Welcome to Property Patter. My name is Emma Humphreys and I'm joined today by two members from our property litigation team at Charles Russell Speechleys, Lauren Fraser and Emma Preece. Today we want to focus on the topic of break options and avoiding the scares which are often illustrated in cases before the courts when it comes to achieving valid service of break notices and or successfully operating a break right. We regularly advise on exercising break options, and it's certainly my experience that achieving this is rarely as straightforward as it should be. So how do we avoid the nightmares? Lauren, if we start with the basics here, if someone's preparing a break notice, is there any particular form it needs to be in?
Well, the first thing I would say is something that you're probably going to hear repeated quite a lot in this podcast, which is read the lease. Unless the lease provides that there's a specific form for the notice, a letter could probably be enough. There isn't anything in statute or anything prescribed for a break notice. I personally would prepare a separate notice so that all the details that you need to include are clearly set out. You don't overlook anything and the recipient is very clear what you're trying to do. So that's setting out who the break notice is from, and you need to check in the lease who has got the right to exercise the break notice, who the notices to, and make sure it's being served on the right party, what property the notice relates to, and just checking that all of the notice provisions to do with period, date, etc. are all clearly laid out. If the lease, in addition to those details, provides for anything specific to be included, this has to be followed really precisely or the notice could be held to be invalid.
So a case that really highlighted that point is Manai Investments v Eagle Star, which demonstrated how closely the break clause must be followed. In the case, Lord Hoffman famously commented, if the clause had said that the notice had to be on blue paper, it would have been no good serving a notice on pink paper, however clear it might have been that the tenant wanted to terminate the lease.
Yeah, and that's a great case, isn't it? Because it really does emphasise the point that even if you read something, you think, well, that's ridiculous, why do you need to do that? If that's what, you know, the clause says, then that is what you will need to do. So yeah, I like the Manai case. It's memorable, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're talking about form there. What about service? Oh, gosh, the joys of service. I mean, where should people be looking to check how the notice needs to be sent?
So most leases should hopefully include a notices clause which confirms how the break notice must be served. And similar with the break clause itself, this clause must also be strictly complied with. Usually this clause will specify the sending methods. Usually this will be either by hand, by first class post, or recorded delivery. And sometimes it's best practice to serve the notice by a variety of these methods. Whilst that is sometimes the case, it's not unusual for difficulties to arise with serving notices. So in the case of the Hot Group PLC v the Royal Bank of Scotland, the lease in question confirmed that no notice will be deemed to be validly served on the landlord unless a copy of the notice is also served on the managing agents. In the case, the tenant served the landlord but did not serve the managing agent until the date to exercise the break clause had passed, which was around 2 months later than the landlord had received the notice. As a result, the court determined that the break clause had not been complied with and the break failed. Other issues can also arise if there's no notices clause or if the notices clause cannot be complied with. If this is the position, then the party seeking to exercise the break will need to rely on the common law rules relating to service, which confirm that a notice will only be served if it has been received by or come to the attention of the recipient or his duly authorised agent. On this point, Lord Justice Neuberger has clarified that simply putting a notice in the post would not qualify as service in such a scenario.
That's when you get into the real nightmares, isn't it?
Yes. What looks like a straightforward notice provision can be made very complicated by the fact of individual cases. For example, I was going to serve a break notice at a landlord at his registered office, which all seemed very straightforward, until it turned out that the registered office was a private island in the middle of a lake, which makes it very difficult to get any comfort that the notice has actually arrived safely and been accepted by the landlord. In that case, I managed to get around it by drafting an extremely polite letter to the landlord, to which he actually responded, which had no obligation to do, so it was just pure chance that we got the reassurance that we needed. But it's just shows how important it is to take every opportunity to make sure that you've checked that the notice has arrived safely.
Yeah, checking, that's the thing, isn't it? Checking. I mean, that's when you're really grateful when you get a deemed service clause, and then you know you can comply
fabulous.
With that. Fabulous, exactly. Fabulous. We love a deemed service clause. And then the secretaries don't, because obviously we have endless copies, as you were saying, Emma, you know, endless copies, lots of different methods, lots of different addresses or what have you. It can often end up being like that, but at least you've got that comfort. Otherwise, as you say, you're looking for trying to confirm things. That's not always that easy, is it?
No, that can be extremely difficult.
Yes, I actually had a similar difficulty when a couple of years ago we had to serve a break notice in the British Virgin Islands, and it was a month or two after Hurricane Irma. So it was just a logistical and practical difficulty being able to achieve this. So the reason why we had to do this was because we were tenant and we were serving on our landlord, and the notices clause in our lease said we had to serve notices in accordance with section 196 of the Law of Property Act 1925. However, that only applies to companies located within the jurisdiction. So the result was that we actually couldn't comply with the notices clause in the lease, and therefore we had to follow the common law requirements, which I just mentioned, and do literally everything that we could to bring the notice to our landlord's attention. So that actually involved instructing process servers in the BVI, who luckily were able to serve. We also had managing agents in the UK who refused to accept service initially, but we did serve them anyway. And we also served in Hong Kong. So I think in total we had about 50 notices.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. It was, yeah, secretaries were really happy with me on that day.
It can be quite a lot of work, can't it? I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we still got, you know, Section 196 it still tends to appear in most property contracts and leases particularly. But of course, people tend to send everything by email these days, if not Instagram. Well, they do, don't they?
Yeah.
And sometimes, very often now I get a letter only by email. I don't even get the hard copy in the post. I mean, can that work for a break notice, Lauren?
Generally not, because the notice provisions in leases that Emma was talking about earlier don't tend to provide for email, and I certainly wouldn't think it's a good idea, just given what would the email address be, given how quickly people move on. Ultimately, this, you know, as a matter of practicality, this is an important notice that needs to come to someone's attention. So unless a sort of email box is deliberately set up that can
accept those
And what if the That's landlord true. Changes or the tenant changes? So that to me seems like an area fraught with difficulty. Mm. And so generally notice provisions and leases do not allow service by email, and so effectively the only way you will manage valid service by email is if you genuinely manage to bring it to, you can show that you've brought it to, say, the landlord's attention. And there was a recent case of UKI Kingsway Limited where the local authority, it's not actually a break notice case, it's to do with rates, but they did manage to bring a notice to the relevant person's attention through a very, very convoluted route that the Supreme Court decided was a valid method of service. I would be extremely wary of placing too much reliance on a case like that, which turns on its own facts.
And the point is, you don't want to get to the Supreme Court to argue about
No,
it,
that's
you?
An
this
expensive
problem,
way to bring
it?
A lease to
yeah.
an end.
Yeah, this is it. They've created uncertainty. They've
yes.
given someone the argument,
yeah.
and so someone's going to take it if it's worth enough to them for whatever reason.
Exactly.
And you find yourself in the Supreme Court having to argue the point.
Exactly. The other thing that I say to surveyors and agents particularly who find themselves receiving these sorts of electronic notices is be really, really careful before you respond to them or acknowledge them, and consider whether that is something that is allowed under the terms of the lease, because you can put your client in a very difficult position. This goes back to the case of MW Trustees Limited and Tellular Corporation, where a tenant served a break notice by email, which wasn't a method permitted under the lease. But in this case, luckily for the tenant, the landlord's managing agent responded to the email saying, "We accept the attached letter and can confirm we are happy for you to break the lease." That meant that the landlord was stopped from denying valid service of the break notice, even though the tenant hadn't complied with service provisions in the lease. And again, had a high court case to fight, so
an
expensive one.
And that's the sort of email you read as a solicitor and say, just grime, don't you?
Yes,
that's just
absolutely.
Not where you need to be.
Absolutely. Think very carefully before you confirm receipt of anything.
That's a really good point, actually. And I mean, break notices, there's so many tricky issues to talk about. You know, you've got the question of form, you've got the question of service, and there's lots of other areas which, you know, I find that we get asked about quite a lot. So one of those that occurs to me, which I think is worth mentioning, and maybe Emma, you want to address this one, is how a landlord's break option should be triggered if the lease is protected by the 54 Act, say.
So the break will only terminate the contractual lease, not the statutory lease, which will continue in accordance with the 1954 Act if it's not terminated. So in such a scenario, it would be necessary for the landlord to serve a Section 25 notice terminating the statutory tenancy in addition to the break notice. However, it is possible for the Section 25 notice alone to terminate both the statutory and the contractual tenancy, but only if it complies with both the contractual and the statutory requirements. If not, then two separate notices would need to be served, so it's probably something you'd have to look at on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, and the point there is you just need to be mindful as a landlord that actually whatever the break option might say in the lease, you've also got the 54 Act requirements.
Yeah, as well.
Yeah, yeah. And what about the other thing I get asked a lot? It's about withdrawing a break notice. What do we think about that?
Yeah, people love to ask this question, but the answer is no. So once served, the serving party cannot subsequently withdraw the notice unilaterally. One thing that tenants might try to do is to stay in occupation after the break date if there is a condition requiring vacant possession, which would mean that the lease will not end if the tenant hasn't left. However, tenants need to be cautious about this because the landlord might look to waive the condition.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. But certainly in terms of a unilateral withdrawal, that's just really not... It's not a thing, ladies?
No, absolutely just not possible.
But what about if they agree? I mean, it may well be that this has been a tactical, slightly risky, but tactical service of a break notice, and it's brought the other side to the table to negotiate and agree whatever it is that the party exercising the break was seeking to agree. What about that? Can they agree something?
They can, but it's going to get really complicated. The thing to bear in mind is that they can't just agree to continue. It's difficult for them to agree to continue the tenancy, and so what is likely to happen is that new terms will be agreed and it will take effect as a new tenancy, which will have consequences that need to be taken account of so that proper steps can be taken. For example, if the previous lease was contracted out of the 1954 Act, unless the proper procedures are followed, the new lease will have the protection of the 1954 Act. So it's really important to make sure that that's covered off. The other thing is that if there is a grant of a new tenancy, there could be SDLT implications that the tenant needs to bear in mind, because that could be a cost to them that they need to think about. In some cases, a sort of more commercial approach is taken, a bit more of a fudge, which is that either if there's something in the break notice which could arguably make it invalid, the parties might just agree that a valid break notice hasn't been served, or alternatively, they, again, going back to what one of the things that Emma was talking about, where there's an attempt at a unilateral act, is that the parties might just agree that the tenant will stay in place so that any vacant possession condition isn't complied with. It's a complicated and potentially puts the tenant in a bit of a vulnerable position. So I think probably the rule is think really carefully before you serve your break notice. And do some proper planning before you pull that trigger.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, because there are ways around it. And as you say, there are some commercial answers. But I think the thing is, it's making sure people are mindful of it, because a lot of time you find people are just kind of like, oh, no, we've agreed, it's fine. And as you say, particularly if you've got an excluded lease, and the landlord may not realise that actually in those particular circumstances, perhaps it's not fine, and they're going to end up with an argument about a periodic tenancy protected by the 54 Act. They won't be too keen on that. Good point. And we've deliberately focused on break notices today because I think we could probably do a whole podcast just on conditions attaching to break rights, so that's one for the future. But to finish up, I've asked each of you to nominate your nightmare case when it comes to showing the difficulties of exercising a break option. So which case has been before the courts that you think is a good illustration of the difficulties which can arise here with break options? Lauren, do you want to go first?
Sure. Well, what I always try to make really clear when I'm advising on break options is that quite often it really doesn't matter how small the mistake is. If it's something that you were required to do on it to terminate the break, you've either done it or you haven't. And no matter how unfair that is, that's where you are. So the case that I'm bringing to the table is Avocet and Merrill, which is a real lesson in looking at the lease and thinking about the payments that are due in order to operate the break. Now, one of the things that we always look at when we're advising on breaks is, when are the payments, what payments are due and when are they due? Because in some instances, you actually have to have made sure that you're up to date with rent and other payments on the lease when the break notice is served as well. That's actually not relevant for this case, but it's just a point I wanted to mention, because it's just one of these things that you need to make sure that you've done. But this relates to payments that were due at the break date in order to effectively break the lease. And the tenant here seems to have taken a bit of a relaxed approach to life. And so ultimately, the real sad headliner of this case is the fact that the lease failed to break because of the failure to pay £130 of default interest. So that's 130. The tenant was tied in for the rest of the term. And in addition, that default interest, the landlord hadn't even demanded it because they weren't required to under the lease. The tenant had just paid the rent a bit late on quite a few occasions. Interest had accrued. They hadn't paid it by the break date, and so therefore the lease didn't determine. It's as simple as that. Mm. So you need to be really careful if your lease involves payment of other sums apart from rent to go and do an accounting exercise over the term of the lease and make sure that they've all been paid. The other lesson from this, although luckily the tenant, well, not luckily because ultimately it didn't work, but the tenant did get over this hurdle, was all sums should be paid in cleared funds. In this occasion, the tenant had, in a, again, a very relaxed approach, paid by cheque on the date of the break date. And luckily, it showed a course of conduct, which meant that that was acceptable. But I think out of an excess of caution, you'd want to make sure that all payments were in clear funds ahead of the break date, just to make sure that you've complied with your obligations under the lease.
Yeah, I mean, we would never risk a cheque on just before the break date.
No.
Absolutely no way. Clear funds.
I think if there's any question about the payments that are due under the lease, the safest thing to do is to pay more than you think, without prejudice to your position that you will seek to get a repayment after the break date. You can have a fight about it afterwards, but for goodness sake, make sure that you've broken the lease.
Break the lease, exactly, exactly. To be fair to the tenant in that case, they would reasonably have expected perhaps to see a demand for that interest if it was actually going to have such a massive effect on their ability to break the lease. You know, I do have sympathy for the tenant in that case, because you know, prior to that case we hadn't had an example quite so strongly, and you know, there hadn't been a demand. As far as I were concerned, they had paid up, albeit, as you say, slightly relaxed on the check sending front. So it's no, I agree with you. I think Avocet and Merrill for me is certainly one of the real shockers in recent years for tenants. Emma, what case would you like to bring to the table?
Yes, I'm just going to mention Siemens v Friends Life, which was a significant case in 2014, which questioned whether the tenant, Siemens, had validly exercised the break clause. So in this one, the clause contained a really quite unusual provision that the break notice must be expressed to be given under section 24(2) of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954. Siemens served a break notice. They did not make reference to that provision or indeed the 1954 Act at all, and Friends Life as landlord then sought to argue that the notice was invalid on this basis. So the trial judge at first instance decided that the notice was valid. They formed the view that the missing words made no difference at all and were meaningless. However, on appeal, the court found in favour of the landlord that break notice was invalid on the basis that the tenant had not complied with the mandatory requirements of the break clause. And that was as a result of their failure to draft the notice to be given under section 24(2) of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, even though that just seemed to be some kind of drafting anomaly, really. Lord Justice Lewison made the concluding remark, "If you want to avoid expensive litigation and the possible loss of a valuable right to break, you must pay close attention to all the requirements of the clause, including the formal requirements, and follow them precisely." So it really was quite a valuable right in this circumstance, because as a result of Siemens' failure to comply with the break clause, they didn't break the lease. They had another 10 years left.
Oh, wow.
So it was huge implications. So I think for that one, it's adopt a quite cautious approach. And like you said, just keep reading the lease closely. Take opinion, I guess, if you need to.
Yeah, and this is comes right back to the beginning, isn't it? Which is reading that lease carefully, the blue paper, the pink paper, even if it says something you think that's ridiculous, why on earth that can't be necessary? Just do it anyway. And in fact, Lewison, who heard that appeal, he of course was a very practicing barrister way back when in the property litigation field, and in fact he knew why that wording was in there. So he explained that at the time there was a bit of an academic argument going on about whether a tenant could do this, that and the other, and blah blah blah. So he said actually there was a reason for that wording being required. But you know, it doesn't matter whether it was pointless or not. If that's what the lease clause says, then you've got to comply with it if you want to exercise.
And if you think that there's some wording that is contradictory and you worry about putting it in to invalidate the break or something like that, then just serve two notices.
Oh, exactly.
Cover your bases.
Yes.
You know, if you were worried that it was so nonsensical that it would cause a problem, then serve one with their wording in and one without, just to out of an excess of caution.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for that, and I hope for listeners that's been a useful explanation as to the common areas of difficulty which arise with break notices. Many of these issues can be addressed through careful checking of the lease, but this is certainly an area where it pays to be careful, especially for tenants who want to terminate a lease successfully and bring a financial liability to an end. But equally, of course, for landlords who have plans for their buildings. Thanks again for listening.